You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Wow. This is like a very swivelly type venue, isn't it? I like to look people in the eye, but apologies if we have our backs to you. I'm really delighted to be here with Mabeen, and we're not doing an episode of the podcast that I host, The Sacred, where we do deep dive into someone's childhood. However, I do like to get a sense of where someone's come from. So can you paint me a picture of you, say, 11-year-old Mabeen? Are you? What are you doing? What are you like?
11-year-old Mabeen, that's very specific. So 11-year-old Mabeen probably would have been watching Saturday morning TV, which was, I think at the time, do you remember Going Live? Yeah, I used to love that show and Top of the Pops in a lovely town in Yorkshire called Huddersfield. Huddersfield has shown up. I love it. And we lived above my parents' shop. They had a grocery store. And so every time someone would walk into the shop, there was a bell that would go. It would go ding. And then that meant there was a customer. And then you'd run in and serve the customer. My dad worked on the buses. So as a special Sunday treat, sometimes I'd ride around on the bus. I thought that was very exciting. So that was 11-year-old Mubin.
And if your teachers had described you, what would they have said?
He can't spell anything. That's what they would have said. So I always had an issue with spelling. They probably would have said he's quite tenacious, I think, and quite loud, and he doesn't stop talking. They definitely would have said that.
And what was the role of faith in your life and community?
So I am second generation Pakistani. My parents came from a place called Sialkot, which is in the Punjab, the Pakistani side of the Punjab, and they are Muslim. And I grew up as a Muslim. I'd say at 11 years old, it was quite casual. So my parents would pray a few times a day, but they weren't kind of praying five times a day. I think around 14, I had this kind of awakening. You've got to understand, the place I grew up in, Huddersfield, very, very Muslim area. So I'm talking about one mosque 30 meters to the right, another mosque 70 meters to the left. All our parents knew each other, all from very similar communities, all Muslim. And I started going to a particular mosque independent of my father. And I got really interested in it. And then I ended up studying theology a little bit later. So I'd say there was a 3-year period where I was what I would call a super Muslim. I was praying five times a day. I would go to the mosque really early. I was the guy that would hoover up in the mosque. So I was like super Muslim for a few years.
And when people think of people with a glittering media career, you've won all the awards going, you've made programs for broadcasters all over the world. They tend to assume that people had a certain kind of background, a certain kind of set of connections, a way to get into this industry. What was the role of kind of media and storytelling in your childhood?
So I'm just guessing, but I think some people here might be older than 30, possibly, right? So if you fit into that category, then you will remember the days of strictly terrestrial television. So you will remember the days of, you know, having even pre-Channel 5, so having four TV channels, which meant that there were particular kind of signposts through the day. There was breakfast TV, there was the 6 o'clock news, the 10 o'clock news, there wasn't rolling 24-hour news. If you wanted in-depth analysis, there was Newsnight, which my dad was obsessed with. He would watch every single evening. For any people here of South Asian descent, you might remember on BBC Two, there was a thing called Network East, which started in the kind of 80s, 90s, which was kind of a look into, you know, the Pakistani, Indian, Bangladeshi communities. So these things were kind of appointments to watch. And they were formative for me. So I would say Newsnight in particular, me watching my dad watch Newsnight meant that I knew maybe, you know, in my teens that could possibly be something that I pursue. Mm. And so all of those things, I think, definitely informed my choice of career.
I'm going to ask you either a very philosophical question or just a stupid question. What is a story?
What is a story? Okay, so on the most basic human level, I would say every single person in this room and every single person in the world has multiple stories and iterations of themselves. For me, a story and the ability to capture a story is to be able to share and capture with authenticity the truth of someone's narrative. I'm probably going to use the word narrative way too many times today, because in terms of podcasts that I do and documentaries that I do, they're what you'd call narrative podcasts, narrative documentaries. And so it's being able to tell that story in a engaging, succinct way. Doesn't have to be succinct, but in a way that allows the viewer or the listener to then take something away from it, take a little piece of that away and inform, maybe if you want to be grandiose about it, inform how they see the world. That is what a story is to me.
I think we live in a time where there's a kind of cultural script that the big, serious, important stuff is money and markets and politics. And stories are something that we do around the side when we have to switch off from that stuff, right? It's light relief. It's maybe anesthetic from reality. But you've poured your life into telling the stories of particular people in very extreme circumstances. Why do you think it's important that those stories are told?
So to me, being able to tell those stories is part of this other quite grandiose idea, which is public service broadcasting. So I spent the vast majority of my career, I started off in tiny little local newspaper, but then the majority of my broadcast career has been at the BBC. The BBC, in a technical and true sense, when it's good, is a public service broadcaster. And for me, and I don't really mind if this sounds too grandiose and worthy. I think sometimes we shy away from things sounding worthy, but I think sometimes it can
you
be
can
a good thing.
You can definitely do it here.
You know, but I can be as worthy as you want to be. Public service broadcasting really is about allowing people to view the world from a perspective they might not have considered. It's about, what do we talk about? We talk about educating and informing people and entertaining them as well. So if you're doing that in its truest sense, to be able to share a story. So for example, the story of someone, I worked on a project which was about people adopting children from abroad, being able to share that narrative, being able to share the narrative of, this is very grim, why someone would become in Mexico a target killer. So why someone would be paid to literally murder people, why that someone would make that their career. Being able to tell those stories allows us to broaden our worlds, broaden our perspective on the world, understand people's motivations, understand the complexity of life, which is something that we all do in our day-to-day lives and with the people we love and the people we care about. We don't often enough get to do that from the perspective of people we know nothing about. Maybe people whose language we don't even speak. Maybe people whose belief system we have no idea about. And if you're able to tell stories in the most authentic way, then it's a real privilege to be able to broaden someone's perspective. And that's what storytelling really is, and that for me, that's why it's important. And I think that's why I do question this some days, but this is why I'm still motivated to do it.
And you tell stories, yeah. I think that deserves a round of applause. You tell stories in a very particular way. You've done a documentary called Behind Bars. You've done one called Black and White Killing, where you're really connecting with white supremacists, Inside Gay Pakistan, Generation Jihad. And this is not, you're not telling a story at a distance by kind of writing up facts. You do it in what's called access work. And I think those of us who don't know how television works don't really know what that is. Could you talk me through what that is and what the process involves for you personally?
Yeah, of course. So I would say I've had kind of two distinct phases to my career. So to be, I'll try to keep it brief. There's a few people in this room that I worked with in religion and ethics at the BBC on the fifth floor on Oxford Road in Manchester. And I've just bumped into them for the first time in 20 years, some of them. And that was the phase of my career, which I was very much in production. So I was a researcher, an assistant producer, a producer director, but I was behind camera and my voice wasn't on the radio. And then I think maybe in 2012, I flipped over and got in front of a camera. You could probably tell I quite like attention, right? So, and got on the radio. In both of those contexts, the connecting tissue is really access work. And what access work is in its truest form is being able to nurture a relationship with people who in many instances, you can imagine, would want to run in the other direction. People who don't want to be on TV, people who don't want to tell their story. Being able to nurture a relationship so they can see the value in telling that story. And so I'm just going to be really blunt about it. Sometimes that can be to do with people's vanity. So in the context of someone that makes a living selling drugs, why would a drug dealer want to tell their story? You know, sometimes it's about their vanity. Sometimes it's because they want to be able to share those details or talk about what they perceive as being glamorous. Sometimes it's a much more kind of moral reason because someone believes that their perspective or their life story is being ignored or the community they come from is being ignored. So there's multiple reasons, but access work is really about being able to make that assessment and then being able to invest in people and nurture those relationships to a point where they see the value in telling that story in whatever medium it might be. That's what access work is.
And I want to kind of know about the inner work that that requires from you. Because nurturing relationships, even with people that we already like or share something with or respect their life choices, can be hard enough. You are going into situations with groups of people that most of society would never want to be with. And the word that comes up all the time about your work is humanizing. In the patient, attentive listening and care that is part of the process of telling good stories in the way that you do, you inevitably humanize someone. And I want to know kind of where the line is between forms of storytelling that are extracting someone's story for another instrumental reason and the storytelling that I think I see you doing, which that relationship is a real thing.
Yeah, I really appreciate that question. So it can be really difficult because there is, I think, with everything, of course, every kind of decision we make every day, there's a moral impact. And that includes, you might think about really mundane things like, I think I just walked past, is there a jacket potato stall over there, right? So when I walked past that, I thought I might eat a jacket potato later. And then there's a moral decision there, isn't there? Because everyone's thinking, why is there a moral decision about potatoes? But there is a moral decision there in terms of what you consume. So for example, maybe the jacket potato isn't the best example, but a plastic water bottle is an example. There's a moral decision there. So similarly, when you start off thinking about a story, we know that there's going to be stories that are going to get, in this day and age, what we call clicks, right? They're going to get eyeballs. But there's a process there of kind of the morality of what is going on when you put that stuff out into the universe. Similarly, with the access work, you referenced the Black and White Killing. So Black and White Killing was it was a two-parter. So it was 260 minutes for BBC Two. It was a few years ago. And I was in Portland and I was following a murder trial. A young man, he was 19. He was called Larnell Bruce. He had been murdered at a petrol station. He got into an argument with a man. The man then got into his car, revved the engine, and drove over Larnell Bruce. He killed him. And then it came out that Larnell Bruce was wearing a particular cap that was left at the scene. and the cap had insignia on it, which indicated that he was a member of a very active white supremacist group. Lionel Bruce was African American. So the whole documentary was looking at this idea of, it was called the black and white killing because of the race element, but it was looking at the motivation. Was the motivation black and white? And in that process, I spent a lot of time within prisons, looking at how people are on this conveyor belt often within the American prison system, whereby they might go in for one reason, but in order to be able to get through the prison day, many of them feel that they have to join gangs that are particularly aligned with their racial grouping, including white supremacist gangs, including what they call brown pride gangs, including what they call black pride gangs. And so you can look at that and you can say, okay, what is the morality around giving these people a platform? Because that stuff is going to end up in the universe. People are going to be watching it on the internet forever in some capacity. People are going to sit down on a Tuesday evening and flick through their channels and then see something and think, okay, yeah, maybe I'll watch this. And, you know, are you going to be informing them or are you going to be polluting their environment? Are you going to be telling them something that is going to ruin their day? And I think in all of those decisions, there is a real weight. There is a real weight because once it's out there, it's always there. With that particular process, and I think this is true of like a lot of the stuff that I do, which is the, I guess what you'd call the kind of uglier side of life. There's a decision about, do we just not give those people a platform? Do we pretend it's not going on? And I would say that's not the best thing to do. Because in terms of a lot of these subcultures, including racist hate groups, you can decide you're not going to do that stuff. And then I think it kind of festers. I think it kind of festers. It's pushed underground and it's pushed into a place where it's not exposed to the sunlight. It's not exposed to reason. It's not exposed to contact with the real world. People live in an echo chamber. And we see that increasingly. You know, we see that increasingly with the world we're in at the moment, the world of social media, the world of online echo chambers. I actually think that stuff is really dangerous. And I think if you cover a story and you do it in a way that's responsible and you ask questions that are challenging, I think you can touch all of that stuff and you can do it in a way that's responsible. And I think that is the equation, the moral decision that you have to make, and you have to check in and ask those questions at every stage again and again and again. Sometimes there's things, you know, there's lots of things, tons of stuff that I filmed that never makes it to TV because the decision has been made, either when I'm in the edit or just when we finish filming something, that something is so beyond the pale that it's not actually going to result in someone being informed. It's not actually going to result in an audience understanding. But quite often, I think there's lots of stuff that I've done that will make people really uncomfortable. But I think ultimately it has a benefit. And that is the end of the equation. Does it have a benefit? I think that's the question we have to ask ourselves.
Yeah, that project, I think, and lots of your other work, one of the lines from it was, everyone thinks they're a victim, right? Once you take that white supremacist guy and you trace back his story, and you see the influences, you see prison, you see poverty, you do that deeply uncomfortable thing of going, oh, I can sort of see how you got there. That profound understanding, but I think what we do is we equate understanding with excusing or even affirming. And you did that so brilliantly and again and again, but I do want you to say a little bit about Small Town Big Riot, because that there is a moment that went completely viral, I think, because it was doing something profound. Could you give us a little bit of background and then talk about Patrice?
Yeah, of course, Patrice. Okay. Small Town Big Riot was a two-part series. It was for BBC One and BBC Three, and it went out maybe 2 years ago. And it was looking at how the British far right, or the far right in Britain, kind of co-opted a model which was based around, I would say, outrage around what people call asylum hotels. So places where asylum seekers are often housed whilst they're being processed, whilst they're awaiting any kind of outcome. And we all remember the summer of 2024 and what happened in the summer of 2024. So we started filming this, I think, a year before that. It was in a place called Kirby, which is in Liverpool. I don't know if any of you from that neck of the woods or you know that area. But there was, there we've got someone waving over there. So Kirby is quite a tight-knit, lovely community. It's where, you know the actor Stephen Graham? So he comes from Kirby. He's like Kirby's big name. So he comes from there originally. And there was a little hotel that had been used for things like weddings and, you know, community events. And within the space of a month, the local council didn't consult anyone. There wasn't a kind of period of public meetings. There was nothing like that. Within the space of a month, what happened is there was an announcement that the hotel wouldn't be used for public events anymore. It was going to be used exclusively to house asylum seekers. And what that resulted in was in the space of kind of 3 months after that decision was made, there was a riot. There was a riot and it was presented on social media as it being all about local people. But actually what we found out through the investigation is there were agitators. And those agitators were, as you might imagine, far-right activists who were saying, these people are coming here. They're coming after your daughters. They're coming after your women. You need to get them out. And what that resulted in, the net result, was people literally standing outside the hotel, throwing in petrol bombs and saying, we are going to kill you. We are coming in and we are going to kill you, right? So that, and it was a model that has been co-opted by the far right. Patrice in particular, I think you referenced. So she was in Ireland and she also had been involved in very similar protests around asylum and asylum hotels. And she was standing for what was called the Irish Freedom Party. And she was a far right nationalist. I spent a couple of days with her, following her around where she was leafleting for the upcoming election, kind of learning about her life. And then I think there's a particular scene, because we've had this conversation before, where we sit down in a cafe and I ask her about a term that she used, which was paper British. So when she was leafleting, she got into a ding dong with someone who was saying, how do you define British or how do you define Irish? And she was saying, she actually used, I'm sure you've all heard this before, but there's this kind of thing that people on the far right say, which is, it's really offensive. So I'm gonna paraphrase, but essentially what they say is, if a dog is born in a barn, it doesn't make it a race horse, right? It's still a dog. And so her argument was, if you come from an immigrant background and you're born in Ireland or you're born in Britain, you are paper Irish. You're not actually paper. You're not actually Irish, or you're paper British. You're not actually British. So at the end of this couple of days that I spent with her in this cafe, we sat down and I kind of just went for it. And I said to her, that term, what does that mean for someone like me? Because my parents weren't born in this country. And she said, yeah, you're paper British. You're not really part of this country. She actually said, and we took it out the edit actually, she actually said, when a dog is born in a barn, it doesn't make it a racehorse, so you're not a racehorse, right?
Wow.
So that was the conversation with Patrice.
Well, the thing that was really left with me is you don't argue with her. You just went, How's your coffee? How's your coffee? Is it good? You responded with such steadiness and such... The response was this... It was. I mean, it's a banal thing to ask, but it was something about her and how was she doing. She dehumanized you and you responded by treating her like a human. And I think the reason it traveled so far is not because she was ignorant and offensive, but because you were not. You were morally serious in a very powerful way. But it's a very it's a very subtle move. And I think it's why I love your work so much, because I spend a lot of time talking to people that I don't agree with. And this question of, aren't you humanizing them? Aren't you giving them permission? In seeking to understand, isn't that unjust? And I think we are in a moment, and particularly with the stories about Islam and the stories about asylum seekers and refugees, it just feels like the temperature's going up and up and up and up. And it's so easy to respond. And sometimes it's the right response with rage or with counter protests or with calling people names. And I'd love you've covered a lot of that going on. I'd love you to say kind of to a group of Christians and Christian adjacent people, what do you think is the call in the moment in terms of our response and the stories we both want to be telling and the stories we want to be consuming? That's like 9 million questions. I'm so sorry.
No. I get it. I just want to pick up with the Patrice point, because I set the scene and I didn't really give you the punchline. And I think the punchline, which you've alluded to, is in that instance, I think it would be really easy for me to make it about myself and to take the bait. And the bait would be, of course, it's offensive to say to me, I was born in this country, all my siblings pay their taxes, all my siblings have, and my parents, you know, always, you know, they live and work here, they're part of Britain. And so, of course, it would have been very easy for me to be angry and upset and make it about me in that moment. That wasn't going to achieve the required outcome. The required outcome, if I go back to what I was saying earlier, storytelling is about allowing you to understand someone else's perspective. It's not about allowing an audience to pat someone on the head and say, okay, I agree with them. That's not the point. It's about allowing you to see their perspective. So if in that moment I got angry and got into an argument and just said, well, you're wrong, that's very different to unpicking, how have you come to these conclusions? I'll tell you the most human thing about Patrice. I found out that Patrice, and she told me this, she had her heart broken. And she told me this, it's in the public domain. She had her heart broken by someone who was a second generation Indian person. She had her heart broken. And that had informed her entire view of people with brown skin. Isn't that astounding? Like she, this is a woman that was standing for election and saying, we need immigrants out of this country. And about 6 years earlier, she'd had her heart broken by someone with brown skin. And that had absolutely informed her entire worldview. You're never going to understand that. You know, similarly, we were talking about a black and white killing. There was a guy that I met called Jason. Jason was a white supremacist in Portland. And he had a word tattooed on his right hand, and the word was hate, H-A-T-E. This is really grim, but I'm going to tell you this. When you join a white supremacist group, you have a thing called blood in and blood out. So blood in, I'm really sorry, I know there's younger people here, so I'll be careful about how I say this. When you have blood in, it means you need to attack someone and make them bleed. And that person has to be someone that's part of the target group, i.e. he's a white supremacist. So it has to be someone in America that is not white. You have to attack them and make them bleed. And if you make them bleed enough, you're allowed in the gang. Blood out means you never leave the gang. And if you want to leave the gang will make you bleed. When I met Jason, he'd been in the gang for 8 years. I went with him on the day he had the words H-A-T-E changed to H-O-P-E, right? He left the gang. You can look at someone like that and you can say, this is just disgusting. He's a white supremacist. You shouldn't be giving him a platform. What you didn't understand until we spent time with him, and I spent maybe 4 days filming with him, he'd grown up, he was a survivor of abuse as a child. He'd grown up with the most horrific abuse that he didn't understand himself until he was an adult, until he'd been inside prison, until he'd started going to therapy. That's when he started to understand his triggers. That's when he started to understand why at 14 years old, he joined a white supremacist gang. You're never gonna understand that unless you have these conversations. Are you okay?
It's fine, it's standard. I'm just a weeper. Jesus was a weeper. So you make these incredibly patient, careful, costly, largely but not completely public service funded stories of particular people in particular intense circumstances that can help us understand things about the world that the black and white headlines can never tell us. But we're living in this information environment where when I go onto my, you know, option of leisure time entertainment, I've got a BBC app, I've got an Apple app, I've got a Netflix app, I've got whatever it is. And they sort of look functionally the same. But I, you know, I did a session earlier with Martin Shore about the stories that shape us. I think of the stories that we tell about ourselves, but also the stories that we are listening to and watching and hearing as formation in Christian language, as like have a deep impact on our souls and who we're becoming. But the information environment makes it really easy for us to consume stories that are have a different set of incentives. Could you say more about what you're seeing in the entertainment industry and what it means for your work and the work of people like you?
Yeah, completely. I just want to say the reason I asked if you're okay is because we know each other, and when you cry, I start crying. So you've got to be really, really careful.
I'm going to look away.
Because you don't want two of us on stage crying. You really don't.
Don't you?
So in answer to your question, I used to be really squeamish. I think I've always been really squeamish about talking out of turn about the BBC, because I love the BBC and I love public service broadcasting. I think it's kind of, we're at a very particular impasse, and I'm not squeamish about it anymore. Because we are in an age where there is such a pace and competition for our eyeballs. There is a battle going on for our eyeballs and for our attention. And we live in, everyone knows the phrase, attention economy. Taking our time, and you know, when we wake up in the morning, if many of us, I know I do, you know, lean over to my phone, that's the first thing that I'll do often, even though I've really tried to stop myself. All that stuff is by design, it's not an accident. And that means that when we turn on the TV or when we look at our phones, there is so much stuff that is just competing for our time. And quite often what that means is, you know, I spoke about terrestrial TV and growing up in the age of four channels, quite often the stuff that would get big, it could be salacious. It could be salacious, or it might be wildly entertaining. But generally, it was within the confines of a system, which many people will say was, there was gatekeeping there. And of course there was, which was a problem. Now, what you have today, it's kind of the opposite of that. So the gatekeeping has gone. You know, we keep hearing it's so wonderful and YouTube is democracy in action because anyone can be on YouTube and anyone can be on Instagram and anyone can be an influencer. All you need is content that is good. Okay, that's one way of looking at it. I would look at it differently. I think the algorithm, what the algorithm often teaches us, be it on Instagram or be it on YouTube, the algorithm teaches us, yeah, be good. But actually what you need to be is shocking. Actually what you need to do is grab people's attention within the space of 3 seconds. Actually what you need to be there for is not nuanced. Nuance is the enemy of that stuff, because what does nuance require? Nuance requires time, and it requires understanding, and understanding requires time. The opposite of that is grab them, grab the people as soon as they, you know, put their eyes on that thumbnail, as soon as they see the title. And that requires us often to be more and more and more extreme. And I don't think that's a healthy place to be. I'm genuinely scared. I'm genuinely scared of where we're going and how the idea of British broadcasting and public service broadcasting fits into all of that stuff. We are playing by two different sets of rules. On one hand, you've got Channel 4 does amazing work. You've got public service broadcasters like the BBC, Channel 4, who are, you know, who do get it wrong. Yes, of course they get it wrong, but who are playing by these rules of fact checking, of making sure we are representative broadly. Again, I say we, you know, these organizations get it wrong often, too often. But generally, there's a set of rules
there. They are trying.
But they are trying. Then you've got another set of rules for a bunch of people who are, you know, all they care about is clickbait. So it's like, let's get as extreme as we can possibly be. And in that context, you know, we spoke about Patrice. In that context, Patrice never gets to tell her story. You never, and more importantly, you never get to understand how Jason got to that point in his life. You never get to understand that Jason grew up in an abusive household. You never get to understand why he joined a white supremacist gang when he was 14. All you get to see is he is evil. Here's an example of someone that's evil. All you get to hear is the one line where he says, yeah, I joined a gang, and to do that, I had to make someone bleed, so I beat this guy up on the street. That's all you get to see, and then you just hate him. And it's really simple, because then we just all hate each other. And I don't think that's a healthy thing. I don't think that's a healthy place for us to be, regardless of your religious persuasion. In terms of our morality... In terms of our morality and where we go as communities, you know, that might have different takes on the world, but we share the same space. The idea that we should all just be angry, perpetually angry with each other, is just not healthy. And as you can probably tell, it's not good for my blood pressure. You know, it's just, it's not a good place to be. And I'm an eternal optimist and I want to be hopeful, but that stuff scares me. And we can only start to deal with it if we acknowledge that there's a problem there.
Thank you. You have got a project coming up about being Muslim after 9/11. It's 25 years. Could you tell me what drew you to it and what you guys are hoping to achieve with it?
Yeah, so this is a BBC Two film that will be out, I think, in about 6 weeks. It's an hour long. And the kind of premise... What I wanted to do was draw a line between 25 years ago and where we see ourselves in terms of the politics around Muslims in the UK today. And when I say Muslims, you might think that's quite specific and niche, but I don't think it is specific and niche, because I think the conversation, I mean, let's just be frank about it. There is a shorthand. I believe there's a shorthand for what Muslims have come to represent. So when often the discussion, be it Nigel Farage or Suella Braverman or any of these people, when it's around the threat from small boats, that is often, it's shorthand for the other, and that other is the Muslim community. That stuff that upsets me, I think it should upset us all. And I think... There is a clear line. So the effort has been with this doc to plot the line between what happened then, the fallout, the response, and where we are today. And so over the course of an hour, that's what we tried to do.
And this is a festival of people that see the world differently in lots of ways. But I said one of the things that Greenbelters tend to have in common is some concern for justice and some concern to be some use in the world. And a lot of people here would call themselves Christians. Some people wouldn't. But as we watch this unfold and particularly see some of the stories and symbols that many of us hold sacred and beautiful and beloved being weaponized against individual Muslims, sometimes it's really hard to know what to do. It's hard to know what is the unexpected move, right? What is the trickster? What is the steady? What is the spirit, I guess, calling us to in these times? And I would not like to be asked to speak for all of the Christians, and I'm sure you don't want to be asked to speak all Muslims, but what would be your invitation in these times for a response that feels healthy and wise to you?
I'm really happy to speak on behalf of all Muslims. I'm kidding. No, so I think I want to be quite considered in this. I think what I want more than anything, okay, there's two parts to this. So I want us to be able to have conversations. And that means sometimes asking questions that might make us feel uncomfortable. And I think we live in a time of extremes, which means quite often I speak to people all... I have certain privileges. I have lots of privileges. Like, as a man, I think I have privileges. I think as a Muslim, that I happen to be gay. I think as a gay Muslim, I have privileges because lots of people in the TV industry and lots of people more broadly who would consider themselves liberals kind of pat me on the head because they're like, oh, he's gay, so he's like, he's all right, you know. He's not like one of those Muslims. He's like, he's funny, he's hilarious. Look at his hair, isn't it cute? Do you know what I mean? So they see me in a very particular way. So I have privileges, which means sometimes people will let their guard down around me, and that will result in conversations that I'm not offended by. I just think are worth having. So have conversations, please. Even when you think the outcome might be a bit scary. And then the second part of that is, I think all people who believe in, I don't even want to say believe in God or follow a particular doctrine. That's part of it completely. But have a semblance of, like, you know, one thing we can all agree on is, I think everyone in the room, everyone here would believe in, like, having a semblance of morality, of right and wrong. I think we live in a time where we need to be brave. And so what I mean by that, I'm just going to go for the jugular. I'm going to say it. I have been profoundly depressed. I think all people with a sense of morality have been profoundly frustrated and profoundly depressed with what we've seen happening in Gaza and the West Bank over the past 3 years. And before that, it is the most horrific stuff I think that I've seen in my lifetime in a lot of ways. And sometimes that stuff requires a real degree of bravery, particularly when we think that we could become a target. And I, you know, this is one place where I'm slightly hopeful, in the sense that I think even in the past 12 months, the kind of the Overton window, is that the phrase, of like what we are able to say and not say, is shifting. But I don't think it's shifting fast enough. And I think for so long, people have been terrified to criticize a state. I make this really, really clear. I think it is so terrible to associate what a government is doing with a faith. This is not about Jewish people. Some of the most wonderful people I know who I would go to for advice in my life are Jewish people. And they are the people that I go to pro-Palestinian marches with. They are the people that are on those marches. They are the people that are often organizing that stuff. There is nothing wrong with being able to stand up and say what we are seeing on our TV screens, what we are seeing on our phones, is incongruous with what our government here is saying. And we need to be able to be brave and say when those things are wrong. And so that's a very long-winded answer, but it's those two things. It's having conversations and being brave and being able to say when things are wrong.
Thank you. I'm going to come to the audience for questions in just a moment. So this is your two-minute warning. But I want to ask, of all the projects that you've worked on and all the stories that you've told, which one has left the biggest mark on you?
Oh, wow. Can I give you two? So there's one project which will always stay with me forever and ever. It was called Adopting Abroad. It was a three-part series for BBC Two. I followed a British woman who was adopting a baby from Pakistan. And they have a system over there. It's the foundling system, which some people may be aware of, where effectively... You can, if you believe that you can't take care of a baby, you can give the baby up and it will be taken care of. And so I was filming. You hear my voice in the film. I'm behind camera. I was filming the moment this woman was handed over a baby that was 4 days old. 4 days old, and this baby was handed over to her. That kid is now 16 years old and lives in Oxford. So that has always stayed with me. And I just remember filming it. They went out the room, they came back with this little bundle and just handed it over. And I remember filming, saying, Mabeen, stop shaking. Like, I was just crying and crying and crying. Everyone in the room was just... And I remember, like, thinking, I need to stop.
Footage is going to be no use.
Yeah, this footage is going to be terrible. Like, stop crying. So that stayed with me forever. And I think the other thing that stayed with me, the second project, I did a series a few years ago called Hometown, which was about... you watched
the
Hometown.
Fans in the room.
Which was... Hometown was about my hometown of Huddersfield, and it was about heroin. It was about... Huddersfield is in such a strange place because it's the M62, there's Leeds there, there's Manchester there, there's Liverpool there. And so it was looking at why specifically... Again, this might make people... It made lots of people uncomfortable in my hometown. Why specifically... The British Pakistani community in that area was disproportionately involved in importing and dealing Class A drugs, specifically heroin. And it caused a riot. Like, it was spoken about in Parliament. The local paper ran story after story for months and months and months. People spoke about it in the mosques. The imams were talking about it. There were community meetings. The police called me in to speak about it. It caused a riot. And I think it kind of shifted how people were dealing with that particular issue in my hometown. I would go as far as saying that I'm really proud about the impact that it had on the hometown, on my
hometown. Doesn't seem too far to say.
So there you go. So those two, I think.
Thank you. It's all right. You'll have a chance to clap at the end. Let's not waste the question time. Who would like to ask a question? I have some people with mics, and the thing is too big. Yeah, could you pick for me?
Hi, thank you very much. You've really opened my eyes. I have to admit, I've not watched any of your documentaries.
Terrible.
But I've written them all down, and I'm going home to watch them. I came because you studied theology. And I work in religious education. I would love you to... Thank you for the... I heard someone woo when I said religious education. Thank you, the wooers. And we love people like you. I can see you would make a brilliant documentary about Christian nationalism. What questions would you ask in that documentary?
Oh my... Okay, wow. So on a really personal kind of... gut level, I want to ask, like, where is Jesus in the Christian nationalist movement? Because I have during the Portland story that I was speaking about, some of those people, particularly when I was in the prisons, some of those people identified as Christian nationalists. They also identified as white supremacists. And the cognitive dissonance in terms of understanding the message. And I'm not a Christian, okay? But I'm like wise enough to know the broad message of what Christianity is about. The cognitive dissonance in a lot of these people is astounding. So that would be my kind of gut reaction, but that would be confrontational, which would be counter to everything that I said, right? So in terms of spending time with these people, I would want to know how they got there. That's the real thing. I want to know the backstory. This is the thing in all of these instances, and I think in a couple of the examples that I gave, it's not about the kind of the results, it's about the route. It's not about the destination, it's about the route that they took to that destination. And that's the story that I'd really want to tell. And those are the questions that would define those questions that I would ask.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Someone else has a mic.
Got one over here.
Thanks, Mabeen. That was really fascinating and thought-provoking. You mentioned up top that sometimes someone's reason for giving you access might just be their own vanity. And that made me really curious. How do you sort of navigate it when you feel that someone is presenting themselves and presenting their story to you in a way that you know, or at the very least you suspect, is not fully honest.
Yes, that's really, really important. So I think with the vanity example I gave, I spoke specifically about drug dealers and target killers. So they're real kind of real life examples. And in those instances, you have to verify. And that means that you never, ever, ever take their word for it. I mean, I'll give you one example of the drug dealer stuff. The reason that the way I got to drug dealers in the hometown context was by speaking to taxi drivers. Honestly, like, I spoke to so many taxi drivers who would talk about this system of drop-offs. So this idea that often people would get into their cabs, this is in Yorkshire, would get into their cabs and they'd say, you know, they'd ask for an address or whatever. And then the person getting into the cab would say, no, we're just going up that hill. They'd get to the top of the hill and there'd be a particular tree and then they'd jump out, leave a package at the tree, then get back in the cab and say, take me back, right? So they were talking about this system where drug dealers were dropping things off in weird ways. They'd put me in touch with these drug dealers. Then there'd be this massive period of like onboarding them. And 90% of them would say, there's no way we're ever going to do this. Do not come knocking at my door again. But then the tiny percentage that would say, we'll go for it, you have to verify. That means once they're on board and once they say they want to do it, you have to speak to the people that they do the work with. You have to speak to some of these taxi drivers that they've worked with. You have to say, okay, I'm not going to document this part of it if you don't want me to, but I want to see who you're dealing to. So I'm going to spend a day with you, which I do. So you'd see them actually selling the stuff. Some of them, like, you get to a point with them. This is what I talk about, vanity. I actually worked with some people who were like, oh, do you want to film me actually selling the drugs? You can do that. What? They're like, yeah, I trust you now. Like, literally. So, like, you verify, and you'd never put anything on TV or in a podcast or on radio where you hadn't, there wasn't a whole paper trail of people you'd spoken to and how you'd got to the conclusion that what they were saying was right. Because you're completely right. There are some people that just have huge mouths, and that's not the people. Quite often, actually, the rule of
thumb... They're the ones on YouTube.
Say again?
They're the ones on YouTube.
They're the ones on YouTube, exactly. Yeah. But quite often, the rule of thumb is, if someone is running towards you and saying, yeah, I'm a drug dealer and I really want to be on TV, they're probably not a drug dealer.
Speak out of the gloom.
Hi. I was wondering whether you've ever had... I'm over here. Whether you'd ever had a story that you told and someone had come back and said to you, I don't feel like you really represented me, and how that might have felt to you. And also whether you were feeling, a bit like we talked about with sensationalism, whether you were feeling pressure for a story to be represented in a way that you didn't feel was quite representative of the person, but was kind of an angle that maybe the TV channel were looking for.
Yeah. So for the first part of that question, I did a series a few years ago. I was the series producer on it. It was called Muslims Like Us, and Muslims Like Us was for BBC Two. It was described, it got a lot of attention at the time. A lot of the Daily Mail said it was Muslim Big Brother. It wasn't Muslim Big Brother. But the idea was, we got 10 people from Muslim backgrounds, and they did live in a house. So that bit is a bit like Big Brother, right? And then we filmed it, but we filmed it as a true doc. It wasn't a rig, what you'd call a rig setup. We filmed it as a doc. It was really difficult because the idea was, you had 10 people. And so we tried to make the casting was such a huge part of it. We tried to make it representative of the community. So that meant the majority of Muslims in the UK are from South Asian heritage, but they're not all South Asian heritage. So you had majority were South Asian. You had 2 people who were African heritage. You had a convert. 90% of Muslims in the UK are Sunni, 10% are Shia. So, you know, we work that out. We had 9 Sunnis, we had 1 Shia, we had a gender mix, you know, all that stuff was there. And then I remember one of the contributors, when it went out, the majority of them really loved it. One of the contributors just said, I didn't feel that I got to kind of truly, through the edit, I don't think I truly got to kind of I don't think I was represented. And I would say that I'll just be completely honest. It's heartbreaking. It's really, really heartbreaking. And it's not nice. And I think there's always an effort to make sure people are represented. Sometimes it doesn't work out. And sometimes people aren't happy with it. But you just have to always go back to the roots of why you're doing it and what you're trying to achieve. I think we achieved what we wanted to with that program, but I don't think everyone was entirely happy with it. So there's that. I think the second part of your question was about sensationalism. So weirdly, and again, this is, if you'd asked me this question 3 years ago, I would have given a much more diplomatic answer. I'm not in that place anymore. I think the BBC is in a really strange place because the BBC is not, contrary to what many people might think, the BBC is not in a place where they are pushing for sensationalism. They're not. If anything, the BBC is getting more and more cautious. And this is what I say about playing by two different sets of rules. So there's times where I've made documentaries where I've wanted to top load it with the stuff that I know is authentic and real, but I also know is very, very watchable. Whereas commissioners, and we have this department called editorial policy. Everyone refers to it as Ed Paul. And so people think Ed Paul is a person. Like, are you calling Ed? Ed isn't a person, it's editorial policy. But editorial policy at the BBC, I would say, is getting more and more conservative. They're getting more and more cautious. And quite often what that means is when I come back from a filming trip and I say, oh my God, we've got this amazing footage. You know, someone has said this amazing thing and it's so out there and we've captured the reality of something. Quite often they're really squeamish. And I think that is also to do with the fact that we're in a time where when the BBC gets it wrong, it's, you know, let's have a cobra meeting. It's like, it's the worst thing ever, right? Whereas when, I don't know, Joe Bloggs, who is a YouTuber, gets it wrong, there's no consequence whatsoever. And I understand why there's that mix. Of course, the BBC has to hold itself to a much infinitely higher standard, of course. But this is what I'm saying about playing by two different sets of rules. And that's why I think we're in trouble.
Can we get a mic to the gentleman waving his hand over there?
One more over here.
Okay, let's take this one over there, and then if we'll have time, we'll come back.
Hi there. A lot of the work you do, obviously, you know, what motivates you must be the hope for change. But a lot of it also must make you very angry. And I just wonder how you look after yourself and how that might help us when we try and have conversations with people we, you know, struggle to see the same opinion as.
That is such a kind question. I really, really appreciate that. That's so lovely of you. I'm just going to be really, really honest. My husband is here, so he'll probably shed some, maybe I should just give the mic to him. So we were having a conversation this morning, I think, and he said to me, sometimes I don't know how to look after you. I thought that was such an amazing thing for him to say, and it upset me. But I thought, oh my God, I have to be more clear with him about how to look after me. The reason he said that is because sometimes I do get really in my head about stuff. I get really, really affected by my work. I am massively affected by it. And I do see a therapist. Sometimes the BBC gives me a therapist, which is great. I think all that stuff is really, really healthy. I think I went through like a weird period of like being, as I said, I was super Muslim. Then I was like, oh, I kind of like some of it, but I don't like organized religion. And I think of late, I'm getting back into a place where I'm thinking, okay, what are the tools within religion that can help with my brain? And I think I'm back in that place, or I'm getting to that place. All that stuff helps me. Then the other thing that I really like to do, which is much more practical and less ethereal, is I love techno and I love dancing all the time, every day, 24 hours. That stuff is very good for me as well. And I love music and I love cooking and I just eat constantly as well. All of that stuff. There you go. Thank you.
Thank you. I am looking around. Okay, do you have a mic? Okay. No. Yes. Okay, sorry. I'm asking because I think you're a former colleague. Have I remembered that correctly?
Well, we know each other.
I can't
yeah.
see in the dark.
Hi, Mobeen. Everything you said speaks to me about pluralism. And I'm a university professor in the social sciences, and the social sciences are very much about one truth and about reason and rationality and against pluralism, especially economics, finance, business. There has to be one truth and nothing else. How do you compare the two? Thank you.
What was the very last bit of the question? How do you what? Sorry.
So how do you reconcile?
Oh, how do I reconcile? Yeah, you're right. Everything that I did speak about was pluralism because the human experience by its nature is to do with our perspectives. Even in this room, we can all... the way I can see you guys is different from how you see them. And the way you see us is very different. So it's all about our perspectives, right? And so that is the part of the human experience that I'm interested in and people's histories. When it comes to, I mean, maybe this is the reason that I didn't go into finance, because that stuff like bores the hell out of me. And I don't like the notion of fixed perception. I just don't like that stuff. And I don't entertain it. It doesn't work for me. It bores me. It upsets me. It's everything that I'm kind of allergic to it. So I don't know if that's answered your question, but it's just not, that's just not the world I inhabit, and it's not the world I aspire to be in.
Please, would you join me in thanking Mobeen for a really amazing session?
Thank you. Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.